Brett Worthington with you. The city property boom has stolen the investment bandwagon, and apparently rural property prices are not to be sneezed at.
I recently had a look at the comparison of rural land values versus commercial land values. And when you look at it using the ABS statistics over the last sort of 27 years, rural land has outperformed commercial land. And that's something that's not widely recognised. A lot of institutional investors look at rural land as being this incredibly volatile, low-return asset class, when in actual fact it is actually quite an attractive asset class in the long-term performance basis.
Today, a closer look at who's putting money into agriculture and why. But first, let's get a wrap of the week's rural news. Clint Jasper has them for us. Clint, it feels like barely a day goes past without hearing a story coming from exploitation on farms.
That's right, Brett. There's been lots of stories since Four Corners aired a report last year called Slaving Away, detailing exploitation of workers in the horticulture industry. And throughout this week, there's been a labour hire inquiry in Victoria. Unions told that hearing that some farm workers were being paid as little as $10 an hour. And we saw the same kinds of stories on a recent 7:30 report, which found a group of Pacific Islanders were being paid as little as $9 a week after deductions to pick fruit and vegetables on Australian farms, and they were working under the federally funded seasonal worker program. This Victorian hearing, though, heard labour hire exploitation has been an ongoing issue in the Gippsland horticulture industry in eastern Victoria. George Robinson from the National Union of Workers presented to the inquiry evidence of jobs paying below the award rate being advertised openly in a range of Asian languages.
There's a real culture of impunity in the industry, in the horticulture industry, in the poultry industry, among contractors who essentially have no fear that they'll be caught and held accountable and prosecuted for violations of the Fair Work Act and other relevant legislation. And what contractors are doing is openly advertising positions on farms and in poultry factories significantly below the minimum wage.
One of the workers, Kayla Ho, told the inquiry that she received $14 an hour to work 12-hour days in Gippsland.
I know that is illegal, but I have no money on that time, so I have to do it. It's really tired. Every day when I went home, it's just what I can only do is take a shower and then go to sleep. Sometimes I don't even have dinner.
So some of the stories that you hear in all of these are pretty horrific. They're beyond what Australians would even bother getting out of bed for, really.
And so what happens with this inquiry? I imagine it will report back to government?
Yeah, they're hoping to do that by the end of July.
Now, Clint, I heard during the week that there were fines for a mushroom grower and then a labour hire firm for some issues with payments. What was happening there?
A mushroom farm and the company it uses to source workers have been caught underpaying dozens of Chinese and Taiwanese workers, and they've been ordered to backpay them, essentially. Grow More Mushrooms at Singleton in the Hunter Valley and its labour hire firm underpaid 52 workers, a total of $92,000 over an 11-month period. And the Fair Work Ombudsman Director, Craig Bildstein, says the mushroom grower and the labour hire company didn't pay the casual loading that you're supposed to pay on top of the wage.
They looked up the full-time rate, thought that was the basic rate, didn't take account of casual loadings, and hence we ended up with a situation where these workers were significantly underpaid. I think the largest underpayment for an individual was just under $7,000.
Now, Clint, this whole sector is one that's being looked at a lot federally at the moment. We're seeing these seasonal workers and backpackers, specific visa holders. They're the ones that do a lot of the work on horticultural properties. And now backpackers are set to be taxed even more. It's causing some issues within the government, though. What's the latest that we're hearing?
Yeah, we've heard plenty from backpackers saying that they'll go to other countries for their working holidays. And it's prompting federal backbencher and Nationals MP Andrew Broad to rethink plans to tax backpackers 32.5% from the first dollar they earn from July 1, which is the plan, and to make them no longer eligible for the tax-free threshold. Andrew Broad represents Mallee in northwest Victoria, a major fruit-growing region famous for its citrus, table grapes and wine industry. He met with the Prime Minister and the Treasurer this week to urge for a change in the policy.
Common sense needs to come back into this discussion. This was I think, brought in without a lot of forethought about the consequences. You know, we've looked for a very long time about models to bring labour forces into agriculture. The backpackers have been a instrumental part of that, taking out some of the peaks and troughs. I think it's imperative that we make sure that we keep that workforce coming. And I don't think it passes the fairness test, in my opinion anyway, if you're out in 42 degrees working very hard, that the government thinks it can take 32% of your wage. I think we've got to make some changes, and I think we'll get there.
He's put forward a lower tax rate, around 19%, as an alternative, and the government says it's pressing on with the proposal and that backpackers shouldn't have been eligible for the tax-free threshold in the first place.
I think there's been a lot of questions being asked of regional-based ministers. They've all been deferring questions on to the Treasurer. It'd be interesting to watch this space to see if the Coalition does rework its policy there. One of the other things I've been noticing driving around is petrol prices seem to be getting lower and lower, the signs that you're seeing on the road. What's going on?
Well, it's a good situation for drivers, not so good for the oil barons, but I don't think there's a lot of sympathy for them there. So analysts are actually tipping diesel prices to remain low. They've already fallen 15 cents in the last 3 months, and they're normally one of the more sticky prices to come down. The falls in diesel prices have come as unleaded petrol hit seven-year lows at the Bowsers across the country. Comsec economist Savanth Sebastian says a global oil glut is behind the current fall in diesel prices.
The flow-through effect for diesel certainly hasn't taken place to the same extent it has for unleaded petrol, and I think that's the issue around the refining costs. If you look at the national average diesel price at the moment, it's down just shy of 1 cent a litre in the last week. It's holding around $1.12 a litre. I think this is where it'll stay over the near term.
Last month, ABC business reporter Emily Stewart put together a great piece explaining petrol and oil prices, and it explains things like what causes drops in prices at the Bowser, what caused the current drop, which is that glut, the oversupply of oil, what it means for the broader economy and what people think oil might do next. And on that point, most analysts expect prices might go up slightly in the short term, but will remain lower than what we've seen in recent years if this oversupply lingers.
One of the things that seems to cause a lot of frustration is that variation you see in prices across the country, particularly that urban-rural divide. I heard reports that Eyre, which is 90k south of Townsville, was offering the cheapest fuel in regional Queensland. It's something that Renee Smith from the motor lobby RACQ says it's really a tough one to explain. What are you hearing about other parts of the country, Clint?
Outside of the cities, you don't really expect to see a lot of competition among the suppliers, but an additional competitor has entered the market outside Alice Springs, and that's a part of the world where fuel companies have blamed low sale volumes and the high cost of getting fuel to the Bowsers for traditionally higher prices. Now prices out of town are about 10 cents cheaper than what you're seeing in Alice, and reporter Nathan Coates headed out to chat with people filling up, and he met Robbie.
I think it's great because normally I've got to go into town to get fuel to start with, and secondly I normally take on about 140 litres each time I fill up, so instead of paying, say, $250, I'll fill my car up for 170, so it's a big difference.
When the prices in town are explained by transport costs and you arrive here, what do you think about that explanation?
A bit of hogwash as far as I'm concerned. If one person can do it, they should be all be able to do it.
So you hope this business set their prices at a sustainable level, that they can keep it going?
I hope they have, and I hope the other ones have to bring their prices down to suit, make it more competitive.
What about hog's wash, Clint? Do you think that's an explanation for what's going on?
Not one that's accepted by most drivers.
No, each week we do like to check in about some of the other news that's attracting our eye. What's drawing your eye this week?
The US at the moment, aside from its political madness, is having a really interesting debate about how genetically modified organisms should be labelled on food. And it all kicked off in the home state of Bernie Sanders, the Democratic primary candidate, who introduced a state law that was mandatory labelling for foods that contained GMOs, essentially. And the food industry lobby at a federal level basically objects to that. So they campaigned and lobbied to get their own federal law that will preempt this law. So it's working its way through the Senate at the moment in the states, and they have this deadline of July when this Vermont law kicks in. But it's raised a lot of interesting debates about how you should label foods. given the fact that scientific consensus overwhelmingly says GM foods are safe to eat, why you even need to label them. So it's just interesting watching those sides and how the chips fall and what might end up happening in the States.
It's one that I imagine people outside the US will be closely monitoring as well. It's one that does kick off a lot of debate. Mm. Something that's been drawing my eyes actually in the US as well. In poorer neighbourhoods, it's typically ones where you might see more convenience-based shops, kind of your 7-Elevens pop up. Now there's a push to put farmers markets at bus stops. So this idea being that lots of farmers markets are associated with boutique products and quite expensive produce, but now this idea of taking fresh fruit and vegetables and having it there at the bus stop where people who are on lower incomes can access it, maybe get something nicer to eat and a more nutritious piece of food into their system. So it was on Modern Farmer, which is a US newsletter that does an email out, and it kind of looks at food and fibre right across the states. It's a really interesting read, digging into that thing that we often hear so much about farmers markets here in Australia, but typically you are seeing more artisanal products might be popping up there. So that's worth checking out. We'll tweet out links to both those stories a little later this morning.
The Minefield.
Hi, Waleed Ali here from The Minefield, where my co-host Scott Stevens seems to be able to make absolutely any topic about Aristotle.
Well, you know, when you're right about just about every issue that there is to be right about, it's just crazy not to bring him into every conversation.
Yeah, but Scott, I'm already on the show.
Waleed Ali and Scott Stevens, The Minefield, Saturday, 1:30, here on RN.
What on earth can I say about that?
You are, of course, on RN. This is A Country Breakfast. Let's join our rural reporters. This week, we follow the hay trail. Donated hay from Queensland's Darling Downs travels 1,000 kilometres out to drought-stricken properties in the west of the state. School of the Air kids enjoy some together time in outback New South Wales. And volunteer firefighters aren't going hungry in Tasmania. A local Burnie cafe is keeping them very well fed. Now, speaking of volunteers, what would you do for a free bottle of wine? Pickers are braving 40-plus degree heat to harvest grapes at a biodynamic vineyard near Wagga Wagga.
It's nice to get outside, get some fresh air. It's a bit of a change to my usual scenes. Good to actually do something physical outside.
Let's hope that bottle of wine they get in 12-month time is worth all the sweat they're putting in now. That story is coming up. But let's begin on Queensland's Darling Downs. Farmers have had a pretty good season there, and they want to spread their good fortune to others less fortunate.
You know, three trailers of hay is not going to be the saviour out there, but it's a help. And if, you know, people out there realise that we're still thinking of them, you know, then well and good.
Dolby truck driver Andrew Wright has a big trip ahead of him. He's about to jump in the cab and drive this semi-trailer load of donated hay 1,000 kilometres northwest to drought-stricken properties in western Queensland. He'll be helping people like John Miller from Margot Station near Barcaldine, whose properties have missed out on recent storm rain.
When I see the storms in the right spot, I sit on the western steps there and look. And they're coming, and this year they've just been in the right spot and they just stay out there and rain and stop.
Do you have hope left in you that there's one coming just for you?
Oh, you've got to live in hope. If you haven't got hope, you might as well get out. No. I had hope, but this last week's been a bit depressing because it's not even been hot and the wind's in the wrong direction and, yeah, not good.
Hello, I'm Jodie Gunders. This hay has been donated by Darling Downs farmers Lindsay and Joanne Evans. Like many grain growers in the John Darien district, they've had a good season and want to help those less fortunate. With the help of the Dolby Rotary Club and volunteer truck drivers like Andrew Wright, three trailer loads of much-needed fodder is heading to outback Queensland.
Yes, well, it doesn't rain money out west, and I feel for the friends out there. And, you know, we've had a fairly good season and I thought, well, the least I can do is give them a little bit of fodder. So, yeah, this little bit will help. Sometimes we make hay out of the stubble and sometimes we don't. But this year it was a good crop and there was a lot of stubble there and I thought, well, yeah, the expense of baling it and then, yeah, sending some of it off somewhere was, yeah, the least I could do.
I've just watched you loading up all this hay. How many bales are on this truck?
This truck's got 36 bales. And yesterday we had a drop deck that had 41. So it's a pretty efficient load. And the hay is very tight and they're good bales. So there's, more than half a tonne in each bale.
Now, they have had some rain out there. It's been pretty patchy. But, hoping things turn around for them out there as well.
Well, I hope it does too, and I hope all the gaps get filled in. But it still doesn't rain feed, and they've got a few pets or a horse or something or other, and they still got to keep them alive, and it's just keeping themselves sane. And a little bit of help like this can be a really good boost in morale, I'm just happy to do that.
Some of the donated hay has found its way to John and Trish Miller's place near Barcaldine. They run both sheep and cattle and have been hand feeding for 4 months. My colleague Lydia Burton joins them on one of their regular feeding runs.
So how many sheep have you got left at home?
Oh, we've probably got 10,000 between the two places.
Yeah, okay. How does that compare to what you'd normally have?
Oh, we normally have 12,000, 13,000
Good
season.
So you've been able to hold on to a fair few then?
Yeah, we sold most of the wethers, not most of them, but half of them probably, the older ones. I think it was going to rain earlier, but it didn't happen, did it? There's not even a cloud in the sky. Well, there is one out south there, but yeah, very depressing. Dry and hot and dusty and, you wonder why you're here.
Feeding stock is an expensive and physically demanding task. Twice a day, the millers load up the ute and head out into the bare paddocks to check the stock and deliver some much-needed feed. There's been no break to the season here, and the hot, dry conditions are taking their toll on everyone.
Well, it's very hot and it's very depressing because we're not getting any rain at all, and, it's just so black.
How does it make you feel when you see the storms brewing but you're not getting the rain in your gauge, Trish?
Emotional.
Oi, 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 oi! Trish, you're in charge of driving the vehicle and probably in charge of how quickly John has to get his work done. But on a more serious note, what's it like for you as you drive around the paddock and feed out?
Well, we spend probably a lot of time looking for the cows that we know, and that takes our mind off the actual job, and looking for calves that need help or whatever. So, I guess you think of other things. You can't really dwell on the way it is.
Hello.
What cost is associated with feeding?
No, it's quite expensive. Cotton seed is, we've fed a fair bit of cotton seed out, and that's between $14,000 and $16,000 a load. That's two semi-trailers. And we've got loosen, which is, I'm not quite sure what that runs out at, but it's got to be $15, $20 a bale. So it mounts up, yeah.
So how do you feel knowing that some of this hay that you've been given has come from farmers who care and people that are just trying to be generous? How does that make you feel, and does that play into keeping your positivity up, Trish?
It really does. We really, really appreciate the donations that we've received. They've been very, very precious. Mm.
John, what would you say to those people who have donated to this area and helped you out?
Oh, I appreciate greatly what they've done for us. It's great to think that people do care.
What kind of pressure does it take off you just to have a bit of feed there that you haven't had to fork out of your bank account?
Oh, it's a big difference, yeah. When you're not sort of looking at every bar you put out and thinking, well, that's X amount of dollars and that's X amount of dollars, at least this stuff is free feed sort of thing. But I appreciate it very much not having to fork out for that.
It provides the kids with the only sort of opportunity to get together and do some group activities, and it provides the parents with a day of contact with each other to discuss how they're going at home in the schoolroom, also too with the little kids. gives you a chance to network and talk to each other, so it's a really good day for the parents.
Sometimes getting kids to school or childcare on time can be a challenge, but in Pooncarie, a tiny town in the far southwest corner of New South Wales, it's hard to keep them away. Can you play this? Hello, I'm Emma Brown. School's in today at the Pooncarie Children's Outreach Program, a community-run service headed by President Nerida Healy. Once a month, the group gathers at the old primary school building, playing host to School of the Air students and their parents, who make the long trek into town for a day of face-to-face teaching, a bit of sports coaching, and some all-important social interaction.
Jackson, 6.
Sam, 11.
Ethan, Richard, 8.
So, boys, we're here at Pooncarie today for the once-a-month school day. Ethan, what's your favourite thing about these days?
I like it when I get to see all my friends.
What about you, Sam? What's your favourite thing?
I like to see all my friends too.
Yeah. What about you, Jackson? What do you enjoy?
I enjoy playing.
Now, you do have to do some schoolwork while you're here, because normally you guys all do schoolwork from home. Are there some of the bits of the schoolwork that you've really liked, and what are they? Jackson, you were talking about an experiment before. What was that?
There was a hose over there. I've run over there and you had to stick a few bottles up and then they pop off.
Ah, so did you have to pump some air into them?
Yes.
Yeah. What about you, Ethan? What have you liked when it comes to the schoolwork here?
I like when Dean comes to teach us cricket because we all get to have challenges and have fun.
With the kids occupied with schoolwork all day, their parents get to enjoy some much-needed time out.
Amy Willis from Wycott Station.
Amy Pollard from Manila Station.
Clancy Griffiths from Panban Station.
We can hear the kids in the background doing some activities at the moment. These once-a-month days, what do they mean for your families, Amy?
Well, our girls love coming in here. Apart from the odd town day, our girls don't get to socialise with other kids. So today is a full day for them to socialise with other kids and learn basic things like taking their turn and lining up and those sort of skills.
What about for you and your children, Clancy?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed an improvement in my children's social behaviour, but on top of that, you can talk with other mothers and you feel a little less isolated, more in contact with the rest of the world. But also, we can get coffee and take away food for lunch.
What does the day mean for you? Some of you mentioned, you know, you get to interact with the other mothers, but is it really quite a circuit breaker for you as parents?
It's a huge day, to be honest. Some days it's more, I would say, you could be more relaxing at home and get your jobs done, and it can be more hectic here, but in the long run we do it for the kids because they're the one that benefit from it the most, but it's also a great catch-up and, yeah, sort of de-stress a bit to be able to talk to other parents with issues that you've got or what's been happening or things that you do to make things easier that happen at your home, I suppose.
It's not just the school-age kids being catered for today. The Littlies are also working on their social skills with some early childhood teachers in town.
My name's Vicky Alds and I am the director of the Outback Mobile Resource Unit.
My name's Emma Fenton and I am the assistant.
Well, if you want an easy name, we're the Mobile Toy Library, which is what pretty much everybody knows us as. We're based in Broken Hill and we travel out every week in our Toyota little truckie type thing there. And we travel to places such as Tipperborough, Milperinka, Wilcannia and Whitecliffs, Pooncarie, Polinua, Dareton and properties all in between there.
How many kids a week would you be interacting with? Just a rough estimate. I know that's probably tough.
Well, let's say this week we probably had 6, 15 and however many we've got in today. So possibly 33 at a rough guess. But we have travelled approximately 1,000 kilometres to do that and we've been out for 4 days. We've been out since Tuesday, we left town Tuesday, and we'll go home tonight. So that's where you get the difference between us and the city. We've only had 33 kids, but that's taken us all week to get those children. And those children probably need it more than the children in the cities who can have a regular habit every day and you only have to travel 5 minutes to see them.
Vicky Olds from the Mobile Toy Library Service in Broken Hill, ending that report from Emma Brown at Poon Carey. Still to come on Rural Reporter, volunteers brave the heat to bring in the grapes at a vineyard at Wagga Wagga, and volunteer firefighters aren't going hungry fighting blazes in northern Tasmania.
Hi, I'm Sarah Lewis and I'm the manager of Night Day Cafe.
So Sarah, you look a little stressed. Do we still not know how many we've got for lunch today?
Not at this time. This is like the hub of where the like control and logistics are. So numbers may vary from 60 right down to 35. So we just have to sit tight and wait and see.
Really? They say an army marches on its stomach. And the same could be said for volunteer firefighters. Hello, I'm Margot Kelly. Northwest Tasmania has been battling bushfires since early January. At one point, more than 50 blazes burning out of control across the state. Interstate fireys have been flown in on rotation to give local crews here a helping hand. They need hearty and delicious meals to be delivered to their site camp in northwest Tasmania and the operational headquarters here in Burnie, the nearest city to the fires. That's where Sarah Lewis and her team at this Burnie Cafe come into their own. They've taken up the challenge of catering for up to 60 additional hungry customers a day.
It's hectic, I won't lie. I like the adrenaline rush though.
Have there been any funny requests?
Yes, we had a request for our second night of dinners to do a Chinese banquet. We got, hang on, that's a phone call to tell me how many there is today.
Night and Day Cafe, Sarah speaking.
Yep, 40 for dinner and 50 for lunch. Excellent. We'll see you then. Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, so we now know the numbers for both lunch and dinner. And in 2 minutes' time, we're all hands on deck.
And no Chinese banquet for today?
No. Tonight's kind of like we're... I thought, oh, Friday night, you know, if they were at home, they probably might head to the pub and have a counter meal or something like that. So we're doing chicken parmas for the main, along with chili con carne served with rice, corn chips, sour cream and chili pickle. And for the vegetarian option, we're going to do a eggplant parma. So,
geez, they won't want to go home.
Well... they have to, they're on a rotation of 5 days, so I have had some comments of, geez, I'm going to have to get home just to stop eating so much delicious food. So I don't know what they get at home, but, you know, that's a really nice compliment. Yeah.
Bunny, all right, are you going to get busy?
Yeah.
It's the mouth-watering sound of bacon and eggs cooking ready for a Friday lunchtime.
Okay, so at the moment we're ready to finish the sandwiches off. Maddie is currently plating up our hot savouries. We've just got a substantial order in through the cafe for diners that are dining in our cafe. And so we're juggling the two at the moment. So it's all a go, it's hands on deck.
Yeah, we're fast running out of bench space in here.
Yeah.
All right, it's already just after 12. They're expecting their meals delivered at headquarters at 12:15, so the time pressure is on. The van is being stacked.
Final load in. As you can hear, I'm puffing. I've been running around. Okay. Secure. Right, let's go.
Hello.
There you go.
Hello, how are you?
Who we got around this table?
Steve Townsend's my name.
And you're a local?
I'm a local, I'm a Tassie firefighter.
And what about you?
Aaron Cashin, I'm from Hobart.
And Craig Smith, also from Hobart.
Well, food's been really, really good.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, yeah. The food's been sensational.
Exceptional, yes. Look, it's just nice to have a tasty meal. So, look, we're really appreciative of the meal and the food that's been presented. Fantastic.
They go through a lot of chocolates.
You have dessert with every lunch?
Yeah, we've got cakes and that for lunch, and then we have desserts with tea as well.
So you're well fueled to keep going.
Yeah.
Are you from Tasmania?
Yes.
Wynyard.
How have you been finding the last few weeks? Has it been draining?
Yeah, some days. But we rotate, so some days we'll have 5 days on and then a couple of days off and then back on again.
And the interstate crews, how's it been collaborating with them?
Yeah, most of them are really nice. Haven't had a problem. We're their gophers, so we go do their shopping and pick fireys up, take them to the airport, take them to base camp.
You're their fixers.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
All right, Sarah, we got here in the nick of time.
Yes.
We have got some happy customers.
We sure do.
End of another week. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Tomorrow we are doing lunches again, and then Sunday we'll be doing the same all again. So back to it.
How does it feel catering for people who are down here from interstate? And do you feel like you're part of the mission?
Oh, I've never thought of it that way, I guess. A little bit. I like to think that I'm giving some, you know, some substance to get through their day and keep them fighting hard with these fires that are happening down the west. So yeah, it is a nice thing to know that you're helping them out, I guess, in some way. Yeah.
It's nice to get outside, get some fresh air. It's a bit of a change to my usual scenes. Good to actually do something physical outside.
Emergency department Dr. Jess Roden is enjoying being outside and doing something physical on the weekend. But in 40 plus degree heat, well, that takes some dedication. Hello, I'm Michael Kavner. Jess is one of a number of volunteers giving up their time to pick Cabernet and Merlot grapes at the Magpie's Nest Vineyard near Wagga Wagga in southern New South Wales. And the reward for all their hard work and sweat, a free bottle of wine from this vintage in 12 months' time. Now, you've got a bucket here that's pretty well full. What sort of effort has gone in to fill that bucket?
So this is the second bucket that I've almost filled, and I've been picking for about an hour and a half now.
And so therefore, picking for an hour and a half, what's your opinion of people that do it full-time as a job?
It's actually a lot of a slower process than I expected. I thought that we would be getting through more of the rows with the amount of time that we're putting in. When you look at it initially, you're like, oh yeah, that'll be fine, I'll just pick and keep going. But it's actually proving to be a lot more time consuming than you first expect. So I have a lot of respect for people that do this all day, every day.
At the end of 12 months, there's a bottle of wine involved. How much of that, the fact that you probably think, I had something to do with that wine?
Yeah, it's a really good thought. It'd be really nice to actually, I think you'll have a greater appreciation for the wine itself, knowing sort of the time and the effort that went into actually making that bottle of wine.
People are becoming quite interested in it, as you've seen today, the different diverse groups of people that are here. Yeah, we all love just getting filthy and dirty and horrible and hot and all the rest of it.
Chris White owns this 5-hectare biodynamic vineyard near the Charles Sturt University campus. He put the call out through social media to bring this group of volunteer grape pickers together. You farm biodynamically, which means that you're governed by the lunar cycle. How does that work out when you have to pull in people that are volunteers? You can't just say, you're turning up tomorrow.
In this situation here, that sort of gets left on the shelf to a certain extent. If it works in, then it's fine. If not, it's like this year, we were meant to harvest 2 weeks ago. Unforeseen reasons, that whole chain wouldn't work. This week is the only window we have in the next month.
What incentive do you provide long-term for the people that come in and get all hot and sweaty picking grapes, and you're not paying them, and it's going to your vintage 12 months down the track?
The incentive is to be part of something. And in this day and age, I really think there is a hunger for people to be part of something. We seem to be so divorced from everything that goes on around us. We're all consumers rather than makers. They're sort of getting a little bit of hands-on experience in the making process. It's kind of nice then, you know, 12 months down the track, and then, you know, they get their bottle of wine and think, well, God, it was a bloody hot day. It was awful. I nearly fainted. I got the wobbly boots on, but here's the wine. And you can have it with, and they can have it with their friends or whatever, and, you know, and brag about it. And they've got bragging rights. And that in itself is a good thing.
Are some of the people surprised at the amount of labour that goes into it?
I think probably 90% of the people are surprised at the amount of labour that goes into it. And it's also a thing we've been talking about here, just amongst all the pickers, that just how soft we are in this day and age. Like, yes, okay, it's a hot day, but it's really hurting us. And we're so used to air-conditioned offices and We live our whole lives under air conditioning. We're in the elements here.
I understand, in fact, there was a criticism of a couple of pickers. They're too gentle with the grapes.
Indeed they were. They were being too nice, which means they're basically going too slow. But that's fine. Look, if you want to poke along and cut every bunch and look after it, that's just fine by me, as long as you're here and having a nice time.
And I've caught up with that slow couple taking their time along the rows. Tina Kirkup and her fiancé, Dave Webster, say they're having a romantic time amongst the vines.
It was very funny because we were doing it very, very delicately, just to be told that we were caressing them too much, taking far too much time, and I think we were too busy singing and throwing water at each other.
And the wine itself gets laid down, and in 12 months' time, you get the chance to try it. What do you think of that?
Looking forward to that. I think that's a lovely romantic idea that you're out here in the sun picking them, and then after 12 months you can come back and try the fruits of your labour, and you've got the memories and the fact that you've been out and doing something completely different that you wouldn't normally do on a weekend.
You describe it as romantic. You've both got sweat pouring off you. You're dirty. Smelly. You're grimy. And your fiancé is opposite. Now, really, romantic?
Yeah, definitely. I would say we came here on our first date, and to be back here, yes, sweaty, smelly, you know, the flies, the stickiness of it and everything, and only a couple of hours ago the sweat's pouring off us and we're singing silly songs to each other and spitting water at each other. we've had a ball.
Tina Kirkup and her fiancé Dave Webster having a great time amongst the vines at Magpie's Nest Vineyard near Wagga. This is a Country Breakfast. I'm Brett Worthington. In a moment, how much money is out there for Australian agriculture? It's a topic the Deputy PM is keen to talk up, and we'll talk about it next.
Hi, I'm Miranda Tapsell. Join me for RN's celebration of International Women's Day.
My natural mother said she can't remember ever signing any papers.
This year, I'll tell you about six women who amazed Australia, but you may never have heard of them.
How the heck am I going to get to America? I ran a dressmaking shop. I made myself £100.
Six Australian women reveal.
It's been an absolutely privileged life that I've had.
That's International Women's Day, Tuesday, here on RN.
Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce is a man on a mission. He wants to beef up investment in agriculture, especially from super funds. With foreign companies increasingly interested in the potential of Australian agriculture, Mr. Joyce is asking why agriculture isn't popular back here at home. It's a reasonable question and one that's been pondered by successive CEOs of agricultural companies keen to drive up investor interest. But we can't forget the long shadow of managed investment schemes, nor whether the business model for farms matches those of super funds. Damien Webb is with First State Super, a company which is making forays into farming.
We're definitely at the start of our journey into agriculture. So for us at the moment, I would say in terms of our overall commitments to agriculture overall, it's more than 0.3, but it's not more than 1% at the moment. So it's still a very small allocation in our portfolios, but we're hoping to grow that over time.
How would you say investors and super funds themselves perceive agriculture as an investment? What's the sticking point? Because it's pretty low base.
Probably the main issue in the past has been two main things I'd point to. The first is that bear in mind that when superannuation funds invest and build their portfolios, they've got a very wide array of choices. Typically, they've got shares, bonds, cash, property, infrastructure, and these are very deep, large, liquid asset classes. But super funds have relatively small internal investment teams. They have a finite number of things that they can do. They do a lot of research, and at the end of the day, they sort of want some certainty that they can actually do some investments in scale, typically, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So I think that the problem for the teams that are looking at agriculture has been hard to necessarily see how that certainty of being able to invest, you know, up to 5-10% of the fund in agriculture, which is, you know, often billions and billions of dollars. Australian growers, irrigators, farmers, if you look at them as a segment, they're some of the most competitive industries in the world. You know, they're very, very productive, and they're very, very competitive. So as a sector, it's something we'd like to have more exposure to. There are challenges in getting invested. So what we've approached it, you know, from a more of a credit angle at the moment as opposed to buying equity outright. So, for example, the end of last year, we did about $150 million in a series of sale and leasebacks for almond plantations with ASX-listed Select Harvest. It was a great transaction in that it allowed them to free up some capital to reinvest in more productive uses, you know, grow some more trees. It was a good return for us, primarily from a rental income stream from being landlord of the orchard.
Alison Watkins, who is now the head of Coca-Cola Amatil, former head of GrainCorp, says that, you know, super funds are risk averse. What we need to do is focus on value adding to commodities, so not just sending them offshore. That's kind of happening with milk powder. Where else could that happen?
Certainly, you know, we've been very observant of the value adding that's been going into milk, and I think it makes a lot of sense what she's been saying. Our approach at the start really is to look for more of the sale and leaseback opportunities, and from there we hope to then, you know, build our knowledge of the sector, then move into other areas, which may involve going up the supply chain and taking more of an equity interest in certain ventures. In addition to the almonds, we're also looking at providing capital solutions across the industry. So, for example, we're also engaging with a number of farmers. Tend to primarily be family farmers, but can also be corporate. But we're also looking to offer capital solutions for farmers, whereby they can release some of the value in their water entitlement, whereby we do a sale and lease back for that water. Again, we generate an income stream for us. They free up some capital, whereby they can then redeploy that into their farm, either recrop for high value cropping or increase machinery or infrastructure on their site. And then at the end of that period, they have the first right to buy the water back from us.
How do we make sense of the ongoing floating of agricultural companies like Murray Goulburn, Wellard, Leppington Dairy, that attract really strong subscriber rates, yet as a whole, super investment still remains so low?
This issue of scale, I think that if we look at the broader asset classes in what super funds would term real assets, be they property, real estate or infrastructure or agriculture, property is a very well-developed asset class. It's been around for many, many decades. Infrastructure largely has been an asset class in the last 10, 15 years, primarily around when, the ports and airports and toll roads were privatised, a number of states, but it's a relatively young asset class in the grand scheme of things, been around for about two decades. Agriculture as an institutional asset class, been able to attract meaningful amounts of investment, is only really starting to come to the fore. But I believe that in another 5-10 years, it'll be a far more prominent feature in superannuation funds.
When we see decisions made around investments like the Kidman Company, VDL in Tasmania, the ADM proposition for GrainCorp, how difficult an investment environment has that created for super funds?
Look, I think that agriculture, to be totally honest, is no different to some of the other challenges we face in terms of global competition.
Despite those sort of conflicting decisions around who is and isn't allowed to invest?
Oh, look, I don't think it's too dissimilar to infrastructure. Recently we've had privatisations of a number of sensitive assets. Sometimes there are decisions there that are relevant to the case. So there's two elements to it, I think. The one is I think we've got to acknowledge that Australia is a very open environment, probably more open than most other countries in the rest of the world. So it's a local super fund seeking to invest our local Australian members' money into Australian projects. We do have to compete with local players, but also with offshore players. A very attractive destination. The second element is the regulatory framework in which we operate, and again, it's just part of the investment decision. The key thing for us, to be frank, it's not so much who will be allowed in, who will not be allowed in. The key thing for us is typically when we look at investments and tenders, and whether we are going to allocate our finite resources to look at those tenders, is how competitive it will be, and whether there are potentially other strategic investors who might be able to pay a premium to what we would be able to pay on a purely financial basis for our members.
So, sorry, because that's quite complex. Can you give me an example, or can you break that down a bit more?
Well, I think just to break it down just a little bit more. I mean, when we invest, we're looking to make a financial return for our members, but also ideally, you know, we think it makes great sense for Australian super monies to be invested in, you know, Australian agriculture, which we think is a world beating industry in general. What I mean by that is that in the case of sort of maybe Van Diemen's Land or Kidman, those are two opportunities we haven't looked at. But, you know, in other segments, we know there's a lot of offshore interest, maybe from strategic buyers who are more interested in food security or those sorts of things. They can probably pay a premium that we probably cannot. So, therefore, our interest in those tenders might be lessened.
If there's $2 trillion in Australia's super sector, that's according to government figures, what is a reasonable figure or reasonable slice of that pie, do you think, for agriculture to aim for?
I think that there's a lot of work to be done on both sides of the fence. You know, superannuation could do more and needs to be more proactive. And I believe First State Super is being proactive. On the agricultural side, it continues to be need to be work to think, well, how can we offer investment avenues that make it more relevant and make it more appealing for these pools of capital? They're not investing because they don't want to, if you know what I mean. Like, I think that an interesting observation, you know, we recently included in our newsletter to our 740,000 members that we invested in the almond plantations in Victoria and New South Wales and South Australia, about 5,000 hectares. And, we received an overwhelming response from members who, you know, again, are just normal Australians who are working. And that they were really thrilled to see that their superannuation was
is that right?
A, providing a good return, but also going into something nice and tangible. You know, most of them eat almonds every day. Most of them put almond boxes in their kids' play lunches.
So the whole managed investment scheme stuff has not cast a shadow on those sorts of investments?
It has, Edwina. It has. You know, it's been a debacle. It's been an absolute debacle. So I think the key issue is really around scale. And most funds are not... They've got a lot. We've got a lot of opportunity for how we can invest. And, you know, again, we're dealing with relatively small teams that will do, you know, years of work. And at the end of it, you know, they need to be able to invest meaningful amounts. Otherwise, their bosses will say, why did you, you know, put time into this? So scale is the number one issue, right? And there's a second order to that scale, which is that most of the opportunities are, you know, in agriculture around $2 million, $5 million. You know, ultimately, we need, you know, investment opportunities that are around $100 to $200 million to work on. My take on it is that challenges persist, challenges remain in bridging that gap and providing scale and good investment avenues and opportunities. But I think, you know, that we're at probably somewhere close to an inflection point. And I think that we all just need to work harder, but also need to be a little bit more patient. And I'm relatively confident that we'll see more participation.
Damien Webb is the head of income and real assets with First State Super. He was speaking there with Edwina Farley. Hassard Australia owns and operates farms in a number of states with investment predominantly in grain and sheep. Its parent company, Hassard Food Company, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Qatari government. It's been upfront about its desire to ensure Qatar's food security, but it also wants to be a leading agricultural company within Australia. One of the directors on the board of Hassard is John Corbett.
Hassard is owned by Qatar Investment Authority. Hassard started operations in Australia in early 2010 and has built an enterprise spanning all the mainland states, operating in cropping, so coarse grain cropping, as well as oil seeds and also the primarily sheep production.
So we've heard there from Solis Lake, and of course you'd be very familiar with the debate that we're having in Australia around foreign investment, the need for it, whether we have sufficient safeguards on it. As someone who's representing the investors coming in, how does Australia look as an investment destination?
Well, I guess I'm wearing two hats here, because the other hat I have been involved in is also putting together the commercial structuring and funding for the Australian Grains Champion proposal for CBH. So I've had a look at it from two angles, and particularly in the last 14 months it's been quite intriguing. From a foreign investment perspective, there's a lot, I guess, more comfort in accepting risk and prepared to actually invest into the agricultural sector acknowledging their volatility and risk factors. In the Australian sense, though, we're still seeing a lot of reluctance from institutional capital towards that, which is intriguing given the volatility that they've experienced with their investments in the resources sector the past couple of years. The other aspects, I guess, that go with that is the capacity then to structure investments of a size and scale that actually meets their investment criteria. And that's with the institutional capital funds themselves getting bigger and bigger. They are looking for larger slabs of transactional operations that they can invest into in one line. So they're not looking for $10 and $20 million investments. They're now looking for $50, $100, $200 million in one hit. And trying to amalgamate transactions of that size in the agricultural sector, I think, is one of the challenges.
Given also the political challenges, has the heat in this debate in Australia affected the willingness or the desire of foreign investors to look at Australia as a destination?
Not necessarily. I think they're aware of it and they certainly factor that into what they do. The recent change in FIRB rules around foreign investment coming in and what level you have to go to FIRB certainly slows the process down. It also creates a bit of a risk, I think, in that it takes players out of the market, because if you're a seller of an asset, all of a sudden things like tenders and auctions are off the table for you, because in those situations you're looking for the parties to sign an unconditional contract. As a foreign investor, you can't do that because your contract is always going to be conditional on FIRB. So I think it sort of is having a few impacts out there. But we've seen with recent transactions that certainly foreign investment is still quite interested in coming to Australia because they understand the macro themes and can see through the volatility cycle because they're taking a longer term perspective. And I think that's one of the key aspects here. We've got players who are quite comfortable to take a longer term perspective and do not have necessarily the pressures from their investor group to demonstrate quarterly, half yearly, yearly returns, whereas in Australia that's a much stronger feature of our investment cycle.
Do you see that changing? I mean, we heard from Saul Eslake that even if Australian investors all jumped onto agriculture, we just probably don't have the pool of capital anyway. Mm-hmm. But do you see that reluctance shifting as, first of all, there's a political debate encouraging people to buy, you know, Australians to buy Australian investments, and also we do see this longer-term future, hopefully, for agricultural production increases?
Yes, I do see it shifting for a variety of reasons. I sort of liken to where we are at the agricultural moment to where we were 15, 16 years ago with infrastructure. You know, back then, infrastructure was off institutional radars. It was too hard to invest into. It wasn't liquid asset, and they had a lot of reasons why they weren't terribly interested. Roll forward to today, and every institutional fund in Australia has their infrastructure portfolio. I think agriculture is just at that stage where people are now starting to have a look at it a lot more seriously, recognising it is a very significant asset class in its own right, and also recognising it on a long-term basis, it actually performs or even outperforms some of the other asset classes. So I recently had a look at the comparison of rural land values versus commercial land values. And when you look at it using the ABS statistics over the last sort of 27 years, rural land has outperformed commercial land. And that's something that's not widely recognised. A lot of institutional investors look at rural land as being this incredibly volatile, low-return asset class, when in actual fact it is actually quite an attractive asset class in a long-term performance basis.
I guess the flip side to all of this is that the majority of Australian farms are still family-owned, family-run. When we're talking about increased investment from institutional investors in Australian agriculture, are we actually talking about fundamentally reshaping the landscape for food production in Australia?
I think there is a reshaping of the way that you organise yourself around management and how you create investor appeal. When you look through agriculture, there are family corporate operators now who have developed from very small beginnings. But it's interesting the number of operators I've struck in my career who have started from next to nothing and in a lifetime amassed quite great wealth in agriculture. It highlights that agriculture, well managed, well run, is a very good asset class. Like any other asset class, if you manage it and perform well, you will get superior returns. The trick is, how do you start to marry the management who can deliver that with the capital, and how do you provide the link around that that allows capital to ensure that they do have a, as Saul talked about earlier, do have an investment say because they're providing the equity. So I think there's a few structural things that we're still trying to comprehend and work our way through. We've got different parties doing different things at the moment. I think it's still an evolution, and eventually we will get there, but it's going to still take time.
Well, as always, we'll have to wait and see. John Corbett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hassard's John Corbett speaking with National Political Reporter Anna Vito. And that's a wrap for this week. Thanks to Matthew Crawford for technical production. I'm Brett Worthington. Stay with us on RN.